Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. I write about food, and my favorite part about what I do is finding out the stories and meeting the people behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. And every Wednesday, I get to have these conversations live on air, bringing the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by interviewing some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show every Wednesday at 2 o'clock on HeritageRadioNetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. Today, we've got three very go-getter women in the studio. In the first segment, I'm going to be talking with Chef Marcy Turney and Val Safran, who run a veritable restaurant empire in Philadelphia. They're all grouped very close to each other on 13th Street. And in the second segment, I'll be talking to Priya Krishna, who does marketing and research for Lucky Peach Magazine and is the author of the newly released Ultimate Dining Hall Hacks. It's the book I wish I had in college. We're going to start with Marcy and Val. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you so much. Thank you for coming all the way from Philadelphia to be here on the show. We've had a few travelers on this season. I'm always very appreciative. Before getting into all things 13th Street related, I'd love to rewind a little bit and talk a little bit about your background. So, Marcy, where are you from originally?
I was born in Wisconsin, and from the age of 7 on, grew up in the Poconos.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm. And what about you, Val?
I was born in Indiana and then grew up in Lancaster County.
Awesome. And what brought you guys both to Philadelphia?
I went to school at Temple for mm-hmm. graphic design and then played field hockey awesome. for them.
And I was actually an 8th grade Spanish teacher just outside Philadelphia and moved into Philadelphia looking for, you know, to live in the city.
Yeah. So you guys have graphic design and Spanish language skills, all very useful for
yes.
the restaurant business. Marcy, did you grow up in a food-oriented family?
My grandparents in Wisconsin had a supper club in the 50s for 50 years. And then I think it skipped a generation because my mother would make the canned ham product. And that's what I grew up with, actually. So twice a year I'd be in Wisconsin. The rest of the time, not so much.
Yeah. And what about you, Val? Was food a big part of your...
I grew up in a family where we never went out to eat. My mother cooked every meal, had an herb garden in the back, and, you know, we were part of a co-op and ate carob and peanut butter with no sugar in it. So I learned the healthy way from, you know, the beginning. There was no salt in our food. Our Brussels sprouts were just steamed, and that's it.
And now you guys, among many things, have a line of chocolate, right?
Right.
Full circle. The New York Times, in a slideshow about Philadelphia, including your restaurants, dubbed you guys a power couple, and you guys are partners not just in business but in real life too. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit more about how you decided to go into business together.
Well, I was a chef at a restaurant, and Val worked at that restaurant one day a week to pay for parking, and she wanted to leave teaching, and she called me one day, and she said, do you want to open up a store? And I said, sure. I'm always the one, the dreamer, that's like, let's do it. So we started with a home accessory store. And then in an area of Philadelphia that was the red light district. And then the next thing was my dream, I want a restaurant. So I worked in retail with her at the end of the counter, hated it for a year. And then we started to plan our first restaurant, which was Lolita.
Okay, yeah. So it wasn't restaurant first.
No,
that's so interesting. Mm-hmm. And we've had a lot of women on the show who work closely either with their significant others or other members of their family, and it seems to be sort of a common food and a common theme in the food business. We had Elise and Anna, who are a couple who run a small tasting menu only restaurant called Take Root, which was in Brooklyn. And I remember Elise is the chef, and Anna kind of runs the front of the house, and it's just the two of them. And Anna said that she went into it because otherwise they would never see each other, which I thought was sort of sum that up pretty quickly. So did you guys, how do you divide your tasks?
We really do totally separate things. She runs the kitchens and the back of the house and all of that. I run the front of the houses and kind of the business end of it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's actually, for us, is helpful. We're not kind of crossing over, you know. We do cross over, but I do my thing and she does hers, and we kind of know we've got each other's backs, mm-hmm. you know. So it works out in that sense. I think it would be hard if we were both chefs we were both, you know,
a lot of cooks
worried about the bills or that kind of a thing. Yeah. So I think that's why it does work for us.
That's super. Tell us a little bit more about the area where all of your businesses are.
The area, it's 13th Street. It is a main kind of artery of the city, the Convention Center, City Hall, Broad Street. When we started 12 years ago, it was the Red Light District. And one of the movies was Dawson's Creek at a certain movie theater on the street. And people now kind of think we were so smart, but we weren't. We couldn't afford anything. Mm-hmm. And now it is the place to be. Our restaurants, other retailers, just it is... You go outside on a Saturday and there's outdoor seating, and it's awesome, you know.
Yeah, I guess maybe about 2 months ago, I had the pleasure of having dinner at Barbuzzo with my wife Grace, and I went to go see a very dear friend, Lacey, who lives in Philadelphia, who I think might be one of your most frequent customers and speaks very highly of all your restaurants. But the neighborhood feels there's like a total kinetic energy to what's going on there, and it sounds to me that you guys are responsible for a lot of that and have really transformed so much of what's happening there. And you live in the same neighborhood, is that right?
We do.
Yeah. So it's all within.
It's all right there.
Yeah. How do you balance that? Is it hard to not work?
I don't think we have any balance right now. We're trying to move towards that, you know, just looking for a house that's not right in the neighborhood and trying to find a way. I don't think we manage it well yet. Right now, we're in it from the moment we wake up until, you know, late at night. We love it for now, but, you know, 10 years from now, I don't think that we would be able to have the same energy as we do right now.
So would you say balance is sort of the ultimate goal, or is that kind of
the next one?
It's figuring it out. I wish we had the answer to that, but we haven't quite. I mean, we love what we do.
You're too busy to find that.
Yeah. Right now we're too busy. We're opening things, you know, and right now it's really good for us. So we don't want that to change. So we're riding the wave. We still have it.
Yeah. And I was just before the show, we were talking about you guys are both here today in Brooklyn speaking to me, and your businesses are in Philadelphia. So you guys have a really great team of people that you can now, you know, afford to take a day and maybe
We've been really successful. A huge part of that is our staff. We have incredible staff. And they try not to text us when we're away. So that's great. But if we do get a text, it's something really bad.
I know it means something.
You're only as good as your staff.
Yeah.
That's it.
I think that's a great message. How do you go about finding great staff? Where do you look?
I've had on the back end, back of the house, I have people who have been with me for many years. As we open a new restaurant, I try and offer a job to them so they have a change. We have restaurants that are different kind of, you know, Spanish, Mexican, Italian American, so they can get a different, you know, cook a completely different cuisine and a new experience. And it's, you know, it's like we're two moms.
And we haven't given up the hiring really.
Yeah.
For any position in the restaurant, we still do it because we've found when we've tried to give it up, you end up with situations where you're like, how did this happen? And I think for us, it's, we know if we put the time into it up front and really find good people, and just so much of it is just their personality and their work ethic. Mm-hmm. The rest will teach you, you know, and just the right attitude. So
I would take a great, just someone with a great personality and wanting to learn over a great resume, where I think I've had some of my chefs try and hire and they're like, they've worked here, there, and I'm like, you gotta look beyond that.
I think that's such terrific advice, and like so many good messages are packed into everything you just said, and I think just having the right people on your team can make the biggest difference in the world. And that's so interesting that you put so much energy into the hiring and then more delegating, it sounds like, happens after that.
Exactly.
Which is probably in the long run
It's worth it.
Speaking of, Marcy, you just mentioned some of the different kinds of food that it comes out of all these kitchens mm-hmm. and all your restaurants. Well, let's back up a second because I was about to ask you a question specifically about the food. But so you guys have 7 businesses, which include 4 restaurants. How would you sum up, if you could like attribute one line to each restaurant, how would you describe them?
Lolita, street food Mexican, little known as funky Italian American. Barbuzzo is the wood oven pizzeria. Bring your friends out.
I like that.
And Hamanera is kind of that little bit more sophisticated Andalusian tapas spot.
Awesome. And you create the dishes for all of these places.
I do, and then I, with my chefs.
Yeah.
I try and inspire them.
That was my next question. Where would you say you draw inspiration from, having so many different kinds of food? And
I think when I was younger and couldn't afford to travel, it was cookbooks.
Mm.
And, you know, now then the internet came into play, and now we travel when we can. So it's all that. It's reading, it's going out to other restaurants and being inspired. You know, other chefs have this great like collab thing going on right now.
Yeah,
going to a farmer's market, seeing ingredients you never knew, you didn't see in the marketplace 5 years ago. So everything has changed, I feel like, in the last decade.
Right, we just had these little Mexican gherkins coming to Lolita, and all my little, you know, the young kids who are like 19, 20.
The thing that looks like a little tiny little watermelon.
Yeah, they're like, what is that? What is that? You know,
they're so like weird and great.
Right, right.
And what did you do with them?
It's in an heirloom tomato and grilled Romano bean salad.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah.
That sounds really good. I want to ask you a little bit of a slightly controversial question about all the different kinds of cuisines, which is a question that's come up a bit on the show. Mm-hmm. What do you make of the idea of authenticity when it comes to cooking? I.e., like, you're an American chef making, say, Andalusian food.
Right. We're 2 white girls from the Midwest.
Yeah.
That's what we always say. I think what I do is I go out and I get inspired, and then I try and bring that to Philadelphia and to the customers there. And some things are authentic, some techniques, some sauces, but then I want to use what's seasonal in my area at that time. And so, you know, you bring all that together. So it's kind of my interpretation. Mm-hmm. You have to, you know, hopefully love that.
Yeah.
like how it tastes.
That's great. Last week, I had friends, Katie and Amanda, on the show who run a farm out on Long Island called Amber Waves, and they were saying one piece of advice they were given, which I thought was wonderful and pretty straightforward, was to not grow something you don't like. You
mm-hmm.
know, it'll be hard mm-hmm. to grow, it'll be hard to sell, because you're just not into it.
So right.
I think it's the same thing with cooking.
Right. Exactly.
What's your day-to-day life like, being an executive chef of this many restaurants? Do you spend most of your time managing other people? Are you creating dishes? Are you ordering? Are you in the kitchen? Are you
a
little of everything?
Yeah, I'll flip-flop back and forth. I probably wake up an hour after Val. I hear her on the computer. And I get up, have coffee, and then start my day and go to each of the restaurants, check in. If we're changing, you know, seasonal menu items, I'll be at that restaurant in the morning is when I have to get into a space. And you know, I'm usually expoing at night. But it's coming up with menu items, going over it with the chef de cuisine, going back for the tasting that night right before service. You know, being the mommy, being
Everything.
Being the plumber. Yeah. Just literally everything. And there's good days and there's days that are hectic and crazy and this person didn't show up and now maybe I'm making tortillas today.
Right.
So you have to know how to do everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And what about you, Val? What's your...
I'm the organizer. Mm-hmm. I'm the organizer of everything and anything and anyone. Just checking in everywhere. Checking all, you know, the emails, whether if it's an event, you know, getting her to come up with, tell me what we're going to do, you know, so I can get it to the chef so they can test it. And I'll text her yesterday. It's 3:30. We're meeting Lindsay at 4 to try this, you know, just constantly keeping things moving. And I'm just always trying to think ahead of whatever it is. If it's the shops, it's holiday. If it's the restaurants, it's, you know, what are we doing, you know, the 3 days after Labor Day when it's slow? What can we do to be busy? You know, just having looked at how things have happened for the last decade. So I'm always trying to be a step ahead and always be there for people if they have questions or whatever it is. They expect that, you know, from us.
And do you have other people who work for you on that side of the business?
I haven't been able to find that person yet. We're building out a space where we'll have an office and a test kitchen above Barbuzzo. It's a large space. It was a lot of money, but it's really our dream space to kind of me find an assistant, her have a place to kind of work. And that's kind of my goal. And I have people who work for me, but I don't have a place for them to go. It's just a space issue where I can kind of delegate out things. We have smart people. It's just, you know, putting it into motion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think so much of any business, but especially the restaurant and sort of retail business, comes down to real estate and how expensive that is. And to be in a place where you could, you know, hopefully begin to afford to have a place to group everyone together. Mm-hmm. So that's really exciting and a testament to where you guys are. Can I ask you a funny logistic question about all of your organizing? How many calendars do you have? Do you work off of one that you list everything on?
Every office has its own calendar. Okay. For, you know, employees, issues, events, whatever. And then I have an old school paper calendar.
Really?
I have to write something down. I have to cross it off when it's done, throw the piece of paper away, and then multiple lists of...
I find that a very emotional
process. I already bought mine for next year, so I can transition it. It's just organizing all those things, and that's how I work, you know. Marcy's a little more free, and
that's how she works, and I keep trying to tell her the list never ends.
It doesn't end.
It never, ever ends. So at some point,
we
need to enjoy, you know, some days.
Yes.
So because I'm thinking as you're describing all this, I feel like the best preparation for being a business owner is probably being a school teacher. I feel like
it's the same job.
Yeah.
It is literally the same job.
But you need a summer vacation.
You need a summer vacation. There's plenty of things that I think both of us have let go a little bit that we would have obsessed about maybe 5 years ago.
Right.
But we just physically can't anymore. So you have to prioritize.
Each time we would open a business, we had to let go. We were forced to let go a little bit more, a little bit more. But whatever the one is you're doing right then, it's like you obsess over
it. If you're a business owner, you're all in. You have to be. That's just the only way it works.
Tell me a little bit about after your first business, which was a retail store.
Open house.
And then the second one was Lolita, the restaurant. In that transition moment, because if you had to have some letting go of open house.
Oh, I let go of open house.
It was probably the transition between one restaurant to two restaurants.
Yeah.
That was the
harder one part of it.
Describe that time.
You still want to be at Lolita, but I have to go into all these recipes for this next one, and I'm trusting my baby, like my first restaurant, with somebody, which is huge. And it's hard. That was the hardest one, and then as we would go, it would get easier and easier.
And what makes that easier? Is it having the right staff in place?
I think it actually has been easier with more restaurants. Most of my top people are cross-trained between restaurants. And so if there is an emergency, I have someone I can send. It doesn't have to be me now all the time. It is sometimes, but it doesn't have to be.
And I'm sure there's also such a personal, almost like letting go of even like an ego in a way of like, there are other people who can do it and all that. Yeah.
I remember the transition being difficult because we were opening the second restaurant and the chef that we had at Lolita, ego and power and things kind of overtook him when we stepped away. But there was a moment, there was a month or so where we kind of had to just let it be, because we couldn't get back there, you know, on a daily basis. And it was difficult in that restaurant because there were only three cooks. And it was a moment where we both kind of said at one point, we're never going to be put in this position again, where we're letting somebody not act the way or be professional the way that we want. And that was, I think, a moment for me to say, you know what, if there's somebody who's not working out, you need to fix it, because it taints the entire place. And that was a moment where we learned, move on.
Yeah.
You got to move on.
And now you've got that moment in your back pocket. So
right.
You can
right. But it was so scary in that moment because it was like, well, Marcy can't be in two places at one time.
Yeah.
And we figured it out and you move on.
Yeah. I think these moments of like sort of tension or friction or just which are essentially moments of growth or I think I'm just so happy
lessons
to be able
learned.
To talk about them because there are things that everyone
you either right, you either move or you just don't open another restaurant.
Yeah.
You run away.
Yeah. So speaking of, what's next for you guys? You are working on another?
Yeah, we have one more, which we always would say. People
this
know
is
us
for
laugh
real.
At us. Yeah, we say that's for real. It's about 106 seats. It's the name we haven't said yet. We're not 100% sure on it. But it will be kind of a modern comfort food, kind of old school vibe restaurant.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I can't wait to try it next time
I'm
in town. Before we cut to the break, we're going to go into the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A, which are a couple of questions we ask every guest, and there's no pressure involved whatsoever. So let's see. Maybe, Val, I'll start with you. Sweet or salty?
Both.
Both. Totally by
She's
Marcy.
Sweet. I'm salty.
So together you're both. What did you have for breakfast today? That might be the same answer for both of you.
Steel cut oatmeal
from our market every day.
Every day. And how do you both take it? What topping?
Skim milk and flaxseed.
Granola, raisins, flaxseed, and soy milk.
Sounds good. If I were to look in your refrigerator at home right now, what might I be surprised to find?
1 quart of half and half.
And what's the date on it?
Oh, it's
fresh.
Fresh.
Okay. We drink a lot of coffee.
And then when we wake up, we don't have enough. It's like...
Run down to the market.
Who has to go down to get it? Literally down below, because we live above the market and our restaurant, Habanera.
That's very convenient.
It's the mom and mom shop.
Yeah.
Kind of deals, what I
that
say.
Could be the name of your next restaurant.
Yeah.
What's your go-to snack?
Chicago mix.
What's that?
It's caramel and cheese popcorn together.
Oh my goodness.
Whatever kind of crumble is in the market that I can take away and hide in the apartment and sit and eat it on the couch.
or when I would go, I'll catch her in Barbuzzo in the chocolate kitchen
eating the scoops Budino. Of Budino.
That Budino, I can speak from personal experience, is like, it's one of the best things ever.
It's awesome.
I was once sneaking in to get some money out of our store in the window for the chocolate kitchens in the back, and she's in there eating Budino, and I'm like, I want to go hang out with all my cooks. So I'm behind the counter, and I'm like, you'll never believe where I am right now, and Val's eating Budino.
As you do. I would do it if I had access to the bucket of it. Val, what was your favorite meal when you were growing up?
French onion soup.
Ooh, good answer. And Marcy?
Probably spaghetti and meatballs.
Mm. Awesome. Marcy and Val, thank you guys both so much for being here today. I really appreciate you making the trip, and it's such a pleasure to talk to a couple who have totally just transformed a neighborhood. I think it's amazing what you've done and what you're doing. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be back with Priya Krishna.
Thank you.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hi, and welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. We were just speaking with Marcy and Val, who run a number of restaurants and shops in Philadelphia. Now we're going to turn the microphone over to Priya Krishna. Hi, Priya.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Doing well. Good. Just really envious of the people out there eating pizza.
The Radio Cherry Bomb records out of a shipping container at Roberta's Pizza, and there's a window into the dining room, which is both wonderful and can be awkward at times, too. You're watching people eat their lunch. Priya, I want to talk about all things college food related, which probably includes some pizza.
Of course.
But first, I'd love to let listeners know a little bit more about you. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Dallas, Texas.
Dallas, Texas. And did you grow up in a food-oriented family?
Yes. So my interest in food mostly stemmed from my mother, who, you know, wasn't a very good, who didn't really learn to cook growing up. And so she learned a lot of really what she knows today is from after she immigrated to America, watching cooking shows. So instead of watching, you know, like the shows that everyone else watches, I was watching, you know, the cooking shows on PBS. And that's what I grew up on. I would just sit on the counter and watch my mom learn to cook. And it was that coupled with the fact that my parents are huge travel enthusiasts. So I was really lucky enough to just travel around the world and understand that you can really experience a culture through food in a meaningful way.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. I feel like I very much identify with your mother because that's exactly totally how I learned to cook, was watching PBS.
And now she's like the best cook I know.
Yeah. Awesome. I'm going to ask you in the rapid fire about your favorite meal growing up. I won't cut to the chase quite yet. But the genesis of your book, Ultimate Dining Hall Hacks, began with your own college experience. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that it goes even further back than that. I was thinking about this the other day, and I think it stems from the fact that my parents growing up did not trust me to use like ovens or stoves or really just any kitchen appliances. So I had to get really creative in coming up with things that you could make using really like the bare bones ingredients and equipment. And then I just did that my entire life. And then in college, I continued to do that. And someone told me that that was not normal. And that's how that's how my newspaper column, the Dartmouth Dining Services Detective, was born.
The triple D.
The different kind of triple D.
That's so funny. Yeah, because I was going to ask if you grew up cooking at all with your mother, or if it was more sort of observational.
It was like observational, partly by choice, partly by the fact that
permission.
I left stoves on, I left ovens
got
on,
it,
like they just did not inspire
like
trust.
That's a little terrifying. She's a good friend, and we applaud all of her other good behavior. So you went to Dartmouth. Mm-hmm. You had these sort of kind of funny skills you developed being someone who was interested in food, but you weren't allowed to use the kitchen.
Yeah.
So how did the column come up? Tell us more about it.
I guess one day I was sitting in the student center with my sister, and I was doing
did you guys go to school together?
We went to school together.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Great.
She was 2 years older than me, and I was doing that thing where I combine ingredients. And my sister was like, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm just eating my lunch. And she was like, that's not normal. It was like a classic case of like things I think are normal that actually aren't. And she was like, this would make an amazing column in the newspaper. And I was writing for the newspaper at the time, and I'd always wanted to write about food, but I wanted to write about it in a way that would be really accessible to students. And where I grew up, where I went to college, Dartmouth, most students are required to be on a meal plan, and there's very few restaurants in town. So to me, it made the most sense, like, how can I write about food to these students in a way that that will actually mean something to them and be accessible to them? And that's kind of where the idea for the column came about.
Cool. And what were you writing about before you started your column?
I was writing about Dartmouth culture, and I also wrote for the sports section. I was on the swimming beat. Yeah. I would just, like, sit at swim meets for 3 hours.
So were you yourself a swimmer?
No, I had nothing. One of my friends was a swimmer, and she was like, oh my God, you should cover the swimming beat. And so I just really wanted to write about anything that they'd let me write about. And so I wrote about swimming, and I wrote about Dartmouth culture, and I loved it.
That's so great. And then you got to write about your lunch.
And then I got to write about my lunch.
So
it all worked out.
Speaking of swimming and athletes, I'm going to quote you if you don't mind.
Sure.
I was looking through your book, and there was one part where I just laughed out loud and I thought was wonderful and I kind of identified with, which was you said that you were talking about your dining hall hacks, mm-hmm. as it were, and then how that led to the column and all of that. You said this may have looked lame to all the kids killing it on their sports teams, but I'm the one who got the book deal, and apparently my limited athleticism has finally paid off. So I think you've done quite well for yourself. You turn all that, you know, sort of fun habit of your lunch and then the column into this really great book, which came out this past June.
Yes, it came out this past June.
So tell us a little bit about turning the column into a book.
Yeah, so I was writing the column, and one day I sort of got contacted by our school's dining services. Dartmouth has like its own independent dining provider, and they asked if I was interested in coming on as a student consultant, helping like design the menus. We were about to launch a new set of dining halls. They asked if I wanted to, you know, be a part of designing new dining halls and basically act as a liaison between the students and the administration. And I was obviously like super pumped to do that. And at first it was a lot of like doing social media, helping them plan events. And then one day my boss emailed me saying that they had to go to these dining hall conventions, and I was the only person who was driver certified and on campus. So I started driving this like bus full of like, you know, really like old men to dining hall conventions, and ended up getting to go. And I started interviewing dining hall providers and about what ingredients are found in most dining halls and about what equipment they use, and asked them about my recipes. And that's sort of how I learned about dining halls, not just at Dartmouth, but across the country, and developed the material for the book.
That is amazing. I love that. Do you, so in that experience of, you know, observing all these different dining halls and the providers and everything, do you feel like, did you notice a lot of differences sort of regionally, or depending on if it was like a, you know, maybe like a private school versus a public college, or?
You know, actually that's an interesting, I found that both private and public schools just as of late have been pouring a lot of resources into their dining halls. There's still obviously a lot of variation, but it was incredible to me through the years going to these conventions how accommodating dining halls were. Like there was a whole station of just like gluten-free pastas. And I feel like in today's world, with all the individualized diet preferences, not having like ample gluten-free or vegan options just like isn't acceptable at a dining hall anymore. So just seeing dining halls move towards that was pretty cool to see, I think. That was just like a general trend I saw. You know,
I love
the
trend report on the dining halls.
Yeah.
I guess it's amazing because when you think about they're catering to, you know, a huge population, students from all different places.
Yeah.
And you're also talking about a population of people who are kind of figuring out
100%
their identities and like, you know.
I mean, people complain about dining halls all the time, but I like to say that a dining hall is like a, so when you go to a restaurant, you are picking the restaurant, and it's not a restaurant you go to every day. It's just a restaurant that you're just going to. But a dining hall is like a restaurant where you don't have a choice, you just go. They're catering to not just people with like who like Italian food, but people with dozens of different food preferences, and you have to go every single day. So it's like really no wonder that people, the dining halls get so much flack, but I don't think all of it's justified.
Did you write your thesis on dining halls?
I wrote my thesis on the notion, I wrote it in French, on the notion of taste and the rise of French cuisine.
Wow. That's impressive.
So it's like somewhat similar but different.
I want to read your master's on the dining hall. I think it's going to be great. I have it all planned out in my head. Are the stories and the recipes in your book the same as the ones that were in your column, or did you come up with new content? How did that work?
I would say about 50% came from the column and 50% were totally new recipes. I stopped writing the column my junior year because I got hired as the editor of the culture section of the newspaper, but I still had a bunch of ideas that I just kept jotting down. And one of my favorite things to do is to like tell stories and stories that sort of examine the connection between food and my life. And so that was something I really wanted to bring in. And I felt like I had started doing that through my column. So it was easy to develop more recipes and develop more stories.
Yeah. And I think there's something really interesting about your recipes because, you know, I'm someone who devours cookbooks and I work in them and I write them. And I think I like to nerd out a little bit on the recipe writing portion of the game, because I think your recipes are based on things that are available in a dining hall and how to combine them. So there's kind of like a very professional kind of chef approach in that, of like having all your ingredients prepped and then taking them and, you know, making other dishes. So did you ever have any
access to sort of professional training whatsoever?
Yeah, so my senior year, there was a restaurant in Hanover called Murphy's that I really, really liked eating at. And I wanted to go into the food industry after college. I wasn't sure in what capacity, but I decided it would be good to have some kind of training. So one day, it was like beginning of my senior year, I just walked in and asked them if they would hire me unpaid and I would do whatever they wanted me to do. So they kind of looked at me with a weird look and they were like, oh, okay, sure. They had never actually hired a woman in to be in the back of house before. They only had front of house staff. So they were super confused at first. They didn't really understand. Like, they'd never had a student work there. They'd never had a woman work there. So I was kind of like this alien.
Off every
yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that was one of the most amazing experiences.
Good
I like
you.
Made a family out of this group of chefs. They all showed up to my thesis presentation in their chef whites, which was like one of the greatest things ever. And it was so. And every time I go back, I visit them first and like fry myself some fries, and it's awesome. I it was amazing.
Well, that's great. How long did you spend in the kitchen there?
I worked there for a year, and I came basically once a week on Fridays, and I worked from 3 all the way until like 9 or 10. And it was great because it was like an excuse not to go out, or I'd go out and smell like french fries and people would be like, who's that person smells like french fries and burgers? Which is fun.
Did that like help you make friends?
I think so. Yeah, I actually think that it did. Yeah, people really love that.
Who doesn't love a burger and fries? I want to know about, because if this was the way that you sort of, you know, it truly came from the way that you consume food in college. This is how mm-hmm. you were making your meals. Is this still like the way you cook at home? I mean, you're no longer in school. You are a young professional yeah. adult in New York. So are you like sneaking into the NYU dining hall now?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could say that I like am a really sophisticated cook and make myself like really nice meals every night, but I still use most of the recipes from my cookbook because they're just as applicable in the real world as they were in college. And a lot of like the shortcuts and stuff I still use.
And what's your, do you have a favorite shortcut in the book?
My favorite shortcut? Something that I really love is, oh, there's this recipe for like Asian lettuce wraps where you take grilled chicken and then you can make your own peanut sauce at the dining halls. And then you can put like radishes, carrots, bean sprouts. And then you take like a big lettuce leaf that they usually have in the sandwich area. And you just put like the chicken, vegetables, peanut sauce, and you wrap it all up. And it's really delicious.
I love in your book the sort of like map of the dining hall because you kind of...
Yeah.
You know, it's as a student or anyone with access to a cafeteria of sorts, it's, you know, I think it's important and fun to remember that you can take something from one area and bring it to another.
Definitely.
Like maybe use the garnish on something for
that's something that people just don't, yeah, they don't do that enough. Like you can like use pesto as like a salad dressing or put like meatballs in a sandwich. Mm-hmm. And people just
look
don't
at you
eat
go.
Those. I know.
That's so super. No, but there's something just really great about all of it, especially the sort of sentiment of creativity and you're sort of taking things that aren't normally that exciting, for example, your college dining hall food, and turning it into something fun and memorable on like a daily basis. So that's pretty great. In addition to the book, you have a day job. You work
yes.
at Lucky Peach Magazine.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about your role there.
So I do a lot of like marketing and outreach. Like I do a lot of outreach to potential sponsors and help to manage those relationships. I help plan our events. I help sort of determine like where Lucky Peach will be. I do a lot of like strategy about like what kinds of places do we want to sell Lucky Peach and how can we get Lucky Peach at those places. So yeah, it's a lot of just like managing partnerships, which I really like because I love people and I love talking to companies that are doing really exciting things. And it's just so much fun because the best part about Lucky Peach is that really no idea is weird enough. So
that's a nice place to work.
It's amazing. So when we do partnerships, it's not like the way most people do partnerships. Like we can really do weird and wacky events and videos and there's really like no limit to the creativity. Yeah. And I'm like a very weird person. So that works. That works really well for me.
You found your people.
I've really found my people. Sometimes though I worry that I'm like too weird even for Lucky Peach.
No such thing. Just be weird. I think it's great. I want to ask you a little bit, because you, I meant to ask you originally, and if you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I'm 22 years old.
Yeah, so you are pretty fresh out of school.
Everyone here is laughing at me.
I wish right now this was TV and not radio. If you could see Val's face.
It's like the big surprise. Like, she's not the father.
I have to recover from that. I want to ask you, at the, because you're still this pretty like early point in your career, and you have so firmly gotten your foot in the sort of food writing door in both cookbooks and magazines. And I want to know from you what advice you would give to college students or any young person interested in following a similar path.
I would say just don't be afraid to push the boundaries. The only thing you'll ever accomplish anything lofty is by having lofty goals. I never even like dreamed that I would ever have a cookbook, but I just decided to do it, and the worst that people can say is no. If you don't ask, you won't receive. So I think that, especially, I was having a conversation with my roommates yesterday about just like women and like being go-getters, and I think that like there aren't enough like women like just like going after and like be, you know, just like seizing what they want.
Yeah.
And like being aggressive about it. Not like too aggressive, obviously, but I don't know. I don't think there's anything wrong with reaching like further than you could have imagined possible.
Yeah.
I find that really awesome. To be honest,
I could not agree more. I think it's just like what you're talking about sort of knocking on the kitchen door of that restaurant, and it's like,
yeah, I mean, he was on the phone. Yeah. He told me to go away. Yeah. I kept coming back.
And you didn't. And that is, you know, we need more women like that in the world. So that's pretty awesome.
Thank you.
We're going to go into the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A, if that's all right.
Yeah,
okay,
sure.
So no pressure.
Okay.
Number one, sweet or salty?
Salty.
Salty. Number two, what did you have for breakfast today?
Barbara's Morning Oat Crunch with a clementine.
Oh. Like on it or
no, on the side.
Okay.
On the side.
If I were to look into your refrigerator right now, what might I be surprised to find?
This like really fancy French mustard that I should have eaten like a year ago, but still in my fridge because it was expensive.
So it's aging.
It's aging. Yeah.
It's gonna be great. What's your go-to snack?
Yogurt with chocolate chips in it, or just plain peanut butter and jelly in a bowl. It's weird, but I love it.
Do you eat it with a spoon?
Or? Yeah, you know, I just put it to both in a bowl and eat it with a spoon. Ask anyone, they're like, it's the weirdest thing she does, but I love it.
That's not too crazy. Where do you want to travel to next?
Turkey.
Awesome. And what was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Thai between cheese enchiladas with rice and beans from this restaurant in Dallas called Mi Cocina. And I'm going to go there. Olive Gardens, portobello mushroom ravioli with sun-dried tomato cream sauce.
That sounds delicious.
With those Andes chocolate mints that Olive Garden used to serve but discontinued. They were so, it was just so, that was like my dream meal.
I love it.
Or anything from the macaroni grill. I had sophisticated tastes.
And what about your favorite meal that your mom made?
My favorite meal my mom made.
I'm only asking because you mentioned she was a great cook.
Yes.
Yeah.
She makes these amazing things called roti pizzas. Roti is like this flat Indian bread, and she'll put like thinly sliced potatoes and rosemary and Parmesan on them. She'll put like sun-dried tomatoes, feta, Kalamata olives, and she'll make just like a ton of them, and they get really crispy, and they're just kind of like really yummy thin crust pizzas.
So your mom was combining.
Yeah, it's kind of a mixture
things.
from like Indian, Italian, and. Yeah,
so it's in your blood. The hacks are in your blood.
No, it's totally true. It's all for my mom.
That's so great. Priya, thank you so much for being here today.
Of course. Well, thanks for having me.
It's exciting to talk to someone who's, you know, at the beginning of their career, and we're excited to see what else is next for you. You can be found on Twitter at PK Gourmet.
PK Gourmet.
Handle.
Yes.
And your book is available in bookstores and online places like Amazon,
yes.
Which you may have heard of. Marcy and Val, who were on earlier, your Twitter handle, Marcy, is just Marcy Turney. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And Val, yours is...
at Valerie Saffron.
Perfect. And you guys, all of your restaurants and stores and everything reside together online at weheartphilly.com, which is probably the best website name ever. So check it out. And as always, thank you everyone for listening. Tune in next Wednesday at 2:00 on Heritage for another episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.